I'm focusing today on a subject that, if you just say it, it sounds like a sidebar issue. It sounds like a nothing burger. I want to talk about soul winning versus outreach. And I knew Ron was going to be sharing today, and so I wanted to kind of ride that wave of what he's talking about. Some teachings are inspirational. Some teachings are educational. Some are both. But today is going to lean a little more toward the educational side of things. I don't hear the term soul winning used as much today as we used to hear it used in the 60s and 70s and 80s especially. But the concept is still built into many people's thinking. The idea is that we are constantly looking for people that we might lead to Jesus, which in and of itself is a good thing. The problem happens when we begin to operate in such a way with that agenda that people begin to perceive that we have an agenda and we start turning people off. Have you ever had someone say something to you like, hey, I'd really like to talk to you sometime because there's this great opportunity that I've just learned about that I want to sit down and talk with you about. All of a sudden, you think, run. Yeah, I mean, I do anyway, because I know it's probably a pyramid sales thing, and I'm not interested in that. Many of us in the 70s and 80s memorized what we call the Romans Road. Some of you are familiar with that term. It's a series of verses in the book of Romans that can be used to bring someone to the point of praying a prayer for salvation. A lot of us, I could still probably go through those in my mind. I think I can. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not a wrong approach. But with so much marketing going on today, and even marketing in the church, people today are very sensitive to being manipulated, very sensitive to sales techniques, very sensitive to pressure tactics. For example, again, this may be me and not you, but if I go into a large department store and there's this very smooth salesperson that approaches me and they start asking leading questions and trying to discover my interest, my first instinct is to go somewhere else where I won't be circled by sharks. I just would like some time to just quietly think about it and make my choices. In the 60s and 70s, that was considered good technique. It was taught in seminars. It was taught in churches. We just kind of used the Romans Road as a guide in it, by adding scripture to the technique, but it was really no different than that salesman at the big department store at Sears, or back then, Montgomery Ward. Remember Montgomery Ward? Now, here's where we have to be careful. Have we just changed our technique because the shark approach doesn't work anymore? See what I'm asking? It gets to a little deeper level. Have we just changed the technique because the technique we were using doesn't work anymore? So we're going to shift to a different technique. Or has God taught us something that is more than a fad, more than a technique? What I have concluded for myself, and I think many have concluded this with me, is that God has been teaching us a biblical place in which to put our feet in what the church is supposed to be. Really. And if it's not that, then we're just chasing fads, like Hollywood or some clothing designer. We're just chasing the newest fad and saying, well, what works? So let me say this plainly. I believe that outreach is our permanent call. It's the permanent call of the church and always has been. I think that soul winning, what was called soul winning, and many books were written. One of the books that I just almost memorized was Here's How to Win Souls by Gene Edwards, and it was a step-by-step of how you can get someone to that point of praying that prayer. I was pretty good at it. But I think that whole technique of sales was brought about by well-meaning leaders. I don't think they were evil or anything like that. I think it was contrived by well-meaning leaders that simply, I believe, missed the mark of the human heart and missed the mark of God's heart. Manipulation and sales techniques and getting someone into a corner to make a decision has always been the world's way. Listen to these words. Relationship, family, friendship, caring. Hear the difference in those words? Those words are embedded in the Word of God. You can hardly find two pages in the Bible that don't include those concepts, because that's God's call to the church. Always has been. That has not changed. So why do I choose the word outreach? It's not in the Bible any more than the word soul winning is in the Bible. I choose outreach because our call from the Lord has always been a reaching out call, reaching out from the sanctuary, reaching out from our own comfort zones, reaching outside ourselves. That's always been God's call. And right now, it's the best word I can think of to say what I think God calls us to, which is an outpouring of love and compassion and truth toward those who are reaching for God, to those who are inclined. Let me go to 1 Peter right now. 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks your reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Let me read that in the NIV. Always be prepared to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. See, I think we are to watch for those who are reaching. Watch for those who have a heart that is reaching and be guided by love and compassion in that. Sam Shoemaker wrote a piece that I've just kind of kept in my file for over the years. And it's a piece. He was a writer and a preacher in the very early 1900s, and the piece was titled, So I Stay Near the Door. I'm going to share this with you. I stay near the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which people walk when they find God. There's no use my going way outside or way inside. So many people are still outside, and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind people, with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door. yet they never find it. So I stay near the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for people to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing anyone can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and to put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the person's own touch. People die outside that door as starving beggars die, on cold nights, in cruel cities, in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find Him. So I stay near the door. That's a sweet piece. I think outreach is expressed in those words. Reaching for those who are reaching for the door. I think what has brought me to the point of, I believe, understanding this distinction and it being important in my life is that I tried to do the other so hard for so long. And I really remember it really well. I was taking a group of young people door to door, and I was showing them how to make cold calls, knocking on doors. And we were between houses, taking this group along. And the Holy Spirit just spoke clearly to my heart and said, "Do you enjoy doing this? Enjoy." Enjoy? No. No. I am driven to do this. I feel like I've got to do this, but enjoy? No, no. And the next question was so strong to my heart. Why do you keep doing this? Why do you keep doing this? I was literally just beating myself up, trying to fulfill what I thought was a demand up on me of God's intention. And it wasn't at all. It was me trying to measure up to someone else's expectation, and I know who that someone else is. Shall remain unnamed. Experiences of life, though, bring us to places where we come to fresh awareness, and especially experiences that reduce us to an emptiness. I recently received an email from a dear friend. She and her husband are going through a tremendously difficult time, and she and I have had a back-and-forth email exchange. They live out on the other side of Fort Worth, west, and so we have gone back and forth. We're old friends. We've been friends for many years, and they've been struggling with some things, really, really serious things, and she's struggling to understand because they specifically felt God was leading them into certain paths. Paths of business, paths of vocational pursuits, and so forth. But she said, I'm also seeing God do in me, use me in some simple ways. And then she said these words in her email. She said, but you know, cracked pots leak. And she was referring to herself. Her words reminded me of another piece in a book by Peter Scazzaro called The Emotionally Healthy Church. He's written several in this series. There once lived a water carrier in India. He used two large pots for his task. He suspended a pole across his neck and attached a pot at each end of the pole. One of the pots had a big crack in it, while the other pot was perfect. The perfect pot always delivered a full portion of water from the stream to the master's house, while the cracked pot arrived only half full each day. For 2 years, this water carrier made the same journey. The perfect pot became proud of its accomplishments. The cracked pot was ashamed of its imperfection and miserable that it was able to accomplish only half of what it had been made to do. Finally, one day by the stream, the cracked pot spoke to his owner about his bitter failure. I'm ashamed of myself. I want to apologize that I have only been able to deliver half my water to your house. There's a crack in my side which causes water to leak out. Because of my flaws, you don't get full value from your efforts. Then the water carrier replied, smiling, as we return to the master's house, I want you to notice the beautiful flowers along the way. On that trip from the stream, the cracked pot looked around. Did you notice there are flowers only on your side of the path, but not on the other pot's side? The master commented. That's because I've always known about your flaw, and I took advantage of it. I planted seeds on your side of the path, and every day while we passed these spots, you watered them. Now for 2 years, I've been able to pick these beautiful flowers to decorate my master's table. Without you being just the way you are, I would not have this beauty to grace his house. It is the way God works. Yeah. Yeah. You see, our call really only has two aspects to it. Love God and love people. We've all read Matthew 22. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. That's the first and great commandment. But the second one is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Love God, love people. A poll was taken in San Francisco some years back. This was recorded also in the book Deliberate Simplicity. A poll was taken and the question was asked, what do Christians do? What do Christians do? And the two answers that they got back primarily were, according to the poll, they go to a lot of meetings, and secondly, they are against things. That's what Christians do. Go to a lot of meetings and they're against things. I think many have come to that conclusion because we've drifted from those two simple primary aspects of loving God and loving people. Now, we're fortunate that we have a record of the original mold of the church, how the church functioned. It's called the Book of Acts. And it tells us how the original church, the original model, functioned. And really their function, I began to realize, has to do with those two aspects, loving God and loving people more. Because they had worship and teaching, which led them to love God more. They had hospitality in small groups, which led them to love God more and love people more. And they had outreach and compassion, which led them to love people more. I've come to the conclusion that complexity has not been the friend of our mission. Complexity has kept us from our mission too often. And I think coming back to those basic rudimentary elements of our call as a church of Jesus Christ helps us to get focused on what it's really all about. I've shared before that a point of clarity that's come to me primarily just in the last year is that we've been somewhat askew in what it means to love people. I think this had its origin probably in the whole soul-winning agenda concept. Let me step aside from the flow right now and just take a moment with two scriptural clarifications, because these two points of reference in the Bible are almost always used, and I'm not saying this to come against something. I'm saying it hopefully to bring clarity. I did a pretty thorough word search and study of these two verses because I've read so many of those books through the years, and I thought of these two verses because they're the two that are almost always used in every manual that teaches that kind of aggression and cornering people and sales techniques and, you know, public relations. And the first one was Proverbs 11:30. The New King James says, "The fruit of the righteous tree of life, and he who wins souls is wise." What's usually quoted is that last part, "He who wins souls is wise." So we get the word soul winning from, I think, from that verse mostly. But the real meaning of the verse is clarified in really interestingly in the Common English Bible, because I did the word studies first, and then I went to various versions to see which one came the closest to the word studies, and I found it was the Common English Bible. Cody, did you tell me that's the one used for translating a lot? Wasn't that the one, or was it a different one? Okay. I was thinking it was the one that you had mentioned in our small group one time. But actually, it's very accurate, and this is what the CEB says. It says, "The fruit of the righteous is the tree of life, and the wise gather lives." The whole concept there is gathering fruit. It's gathering fruit. It's putting fruit into the basket, just like you go out into an orchard and you begin to gather the fruit. So our assignment is literally to gather ripened fruit, to gather fruit that is ripened. Now, that means we're going to have to discern when fruit is ripening, when it's ready to be picked. And we're going to have to be an influence that can gather people into the basket of the kingdom to do that. The whole concept is gathering in, like you would go out into your garden and gather vegetables, or you would gather fruit. And I thought again of Sam Shoemake's words, "Stand near the door and take the hand of those that are reaching." Those are ripened fruit that are ready to be picked. You ever tried to pull a green something off a tree, like a green peach or a green apple? It doesn't come off very easy, does it? But we get good enough, we say, "I'll take a knife and I'll cut it off." Usually what that causes is in the kingdom, and I'm going from the literal fruit to the kingdom, but what happens in the kingdom is then we have a lot of people going back into the world. Far too many going back into the world because they have been manipulated into a decision. Pray this prayer after me. Be careful. The other verse often used is in the book of Jude, the 22nd and 23rd verses in Jude, which is only one chapter. I'll read it first again in the New King James. "And on some have compassion, making a distinction, but others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment defiled by the flesh." Whole books have been written on that middle portion, "save with fear, pulling them out of the fire." The point that's usually made from this verse is you can be compassionate and gentle with some, but with others, you need to put the fear of God in them. You need to shake them up, and you need to pull them out of hell by force. And really, that is not the meaning that I found in those verses. And once again, I went through the same process, and I found that the message had the clearest meaning as far as what that verse actually is saying. The message says, go easy on those who hesitate in the faith. Go after those who take the wrong way. Be tender with sinners, but not soft on sin. The sin itself stinks to high heaven. Don't you love the message sometimes? Those two verses are used in virtually every manual that I've ever read on the subject of aggressive soul winning that I think goes too far and becomes guilt-driven, shame-driven, like I had. And the real meaning is seldom researched. I'm saying this because just recently in a pastor's gathering, that second one in Jude was used, and it was interpreted exactly in a pastor's meeting. It was interpreted exactly like I just now said, the wrong way. How did Jesus do it? How did Paul do it? Jesus did not say, if you'll get saved, you can then be part of my team. He didn't say that. Here's what he said. It's so simple. Follow me. Remember that? Follow me. What's he inviting here? He's inviting them to eat with him. Huh. He's inviting them to be present when he prays. He's inviting them to see where he lives, or see where he's staying. He's inviting them to hear what he talks about when other people are not around. And they went with him, and they saw where he lived, and they saw where he ate, what he ate, and they saw when he talked to others. And he just said, follow me. Come on along. Now, those disciples got saved somewhere along the way. They got saved somewhere along the way because later they came back from a ministry time and they were all excited about the fact that they had power over demons. Remember that in Luke chapter 10? They had power over demons. Do you know that you have power over demons? I think a lot of people in America think that demons have been somehow sent to Africa or somewhere else other than here. Demons don't have anything to do with us, do they? No. Do you know that you have power over demons? I said this before, and I'm going to say it again because some of you have never heard me say this. After my wife died, four nights in a row, I had demonic manifestations in the bedroom. I was awakened, I was startled awake, and I saw forms. And you know what I felt? I felt indignant. That's what I felt. I felt indignant. I thought, do you really think, as long as I follow the Lord, that you're going to make me afraid like my spouse is not there anymore and God won't be with? I felt indignant. And after four nights, they gave up. There was no more. Yeah. But these guys were excited about it. And Jesus said to them in Luke 10:20, is that up there? Yeah. In Luke 10:20, he said, don't rejoice because demons are subject to you. Rejoice because your names are written in heaven. Rejoice because you're saved. Now, they were saved, so we know that. Here's the point. Somewhere along the way, these guys that just followed him got saved. The Bible doesn't record it. The Bible doesn't say, and this is when John got saved, and this is what you would think that'd be in there, wouldn't you? But it's not. He goes from follow me to you guys are in the kingdom. And we don't know where. You know why? Because I think it happened along the way. And I think salvation often happens along the way, and I think we don't give credence to that in our soul-winning doctrine or in our pursuit. I think it happened at different times, different places. What about Paul? What was his call to the believers? Here it is. He didn't say, if you get saved, you can be part of my team. He said, imitate me like I imitate Christ. Imitate me like I imitate Christ. Our call isn't to corner people into saying a prayer. It is to say, can we walk together? Can we walk together? That's what you're doing here, son, with your Muslim friend at work, at Facebook. Can we just have lunch together? Michael's out, Michael Paddock, he's back in kids' church. But he gives me testimonies all the time of people at Walmart where he works that he just begins to have a conversation with, and then they'll meet over at McDonald's for lunch and just get acquainted with them. Jesus didn't call us to build large churches, family. He called us to live large lives. George Barna, in his, I think it was the 95, 90, yeah, it's up there, the 94, 95 in his Barna report, he said this. He said, "We are more impressed by a church of 4,000 people who have no clue about God's character and his expectations than by a church of 100 deeply committed saints who are serving humankind in quiet but significant ways." Yeah. I think Dave Browning in Deliberate Simplicity does the best job that I've read in defining outreach. Outreach is developing a lifestyle in which Christ has the freedom to express his nature in us as we develop relationships with friends, neighbors, relatives, and coworkers who don't know him. Outreach is a broad concept encompassing all the loving expressions we extend, from giving someone a cup of cold water to personally sharing our faith in Jesus. Outreach can include evangelism, but it's far broader. It includes all our outgoing actions of love toward those who have not yet received Christ, reaching for the door. Outreach is every attempt on our part to love other people. Our love is not conditional upon whether they receive Christ or even show interest in doing so. Of course, our heart's desire is for them to become Christians, but unconditional love provides the atmosphere in which they will be most receptive. And then he goes on the next page and he says, "This frees us from thinking that every contact with a non-Christian must have an overtly evangelistic purpose. It allows us to relax and enjoy the relationship for its own sake. Having this broader perspective, we can focus on people and their needs rather than on their decisions." Pretty good stuff, Dave Browning. Becca, yeah, I was looking for you. The skill of persuasion can be learned. A cup of cold water from your heart can't really be learned. It has to just come from within. A dozen baked goods that are going to be taken to the firemen, cup of cold water, kindness to someone that will never return it to you. Never return it to you. And you don't even have an intention they will return it to you. But it's given. That's the heart of God. That's the heart of God. That's what God's calling us to. And this Friday is our first Friday at Dallas International Street Church. And I'm planning on joining you guys. I'm planning on going down with you. I'm looking forward to it.